Our scripture this morning is from the 25th chapter of Matthew. When Jesus returns in glory, he will say to all the righteous, "Come, you that are blessed, take your inheritance that was prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you gave me clothing. I was sick, and you took care of me. I was in prison, and you visited me." Then they will answer him, "Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry and gave you food, or thirsty and gave you something to drink? And when was it that we saw you a stranger and welcomed you, or naked and gave you clothing? And when was it that we saw you sick or in prison and visited you?" And Jesus will answer them, "Truly, I tell you, just as you did it to one of the least of these sisters and brothers of mine, you did it to me." The Gospel of the Lord.
I haven't listened to much scripture, but that one was, speaks volumes and kind of is, without knowing it, is kind of what Sisu is based around. So thank you for that. So since I could talk about this for hours, I had a little coaching and I was, talk about one of the biggest positives and then talk about how that came to be. And I'd say one of our biggest positives was everything came together and we had our first fundraiser on August 1st. I'm going to try to get through this whole thing without crying, but that usually never happens. But on August 1st, we had a fundraiser, which in itself made me cry because so many volunteers came together and made that such a great event. So many volunteers and friends were able to attend. But when a few of my favorite people to see that day were some of the kids we had worked with at Sisu, and I had suspended services months prior to that event so that I could concentrate all my energy on opening a shelter. But the kids that I had helped in the previous year were family, and at least three of the kids came to the event. Some of the volunteers went and picked up a couple, and then one of the kids, he came in on a bus, and then I looked out the window, and he was leaving on a bus. And I said, "Oh," but Liam, he got to speak that day. He asked if he could, and I said, "Are you sure you want to share your story with everybody?" And he said, "Absolutely." And what he said when he got to the mic in this room full of people was that if Penny hadn't talked to me and reached out to me, I wouldn't be here today. And with Liam, we had been going for a few, when we opened in June of 2014, a day center, someone had provided us this space to see what I could do. And first month, nobody came. Second month, one kid stopped by. And then the third month, young girl stopped by, and it was a great moment. And then all of a sudden, it kind of blew up, and we had 40 kids between October and December, and one of those kids was Liam, and he was brought to the center by his father. He's 23, and he'd been wandering the streets for a couple of years. His family no longer knew what to do how to help him, but they hated the thought of him being on the streets. He suffers with some major emotional and mental health issues, and when he came in, I told his dad, "I got him. Thank you for bringing him." And then I just told Liam, "Have a seat. Here's the kitchen. There's a clothing closet back there. When you get settled in, I'll see you and we'll go talk." He said, "Okay." And then I said, "You're high as a kite right now, aren't you?" And he said, "Yeah." And so I let him just, hang out there for a while. And when his dad was talking to me, he wouldn't make eye contact with his dad. He just kind of disassociated. And he didn't want to hear the negative things about himself. He deals with that every day. So I gave him some time, and then I sat and talked with him. We went out back, and I get their story, and it includes personal information. It includes trauma history, when's the last time they ate, how long they've been homeless, and it collects a lot of data. But we do it in an interview style because we genuinely care about their story and how we can help them. And just in and out of inpatient facilities, almost entire young life. Different stepfathers that didn't understand him, and he gave up on himself after a while. Schizophrenia, bipolar, and he didn't want to be a burden anymore. Lots of theft and just acting out. And so he just wandered the streets, and he had a record from breaking and entering into old abandoned apartments to sleep, and he started selling all kinds of things to get by. And he had SSI, and it would go to his parents' house, and he'd go get it, and he'd end up blowing it in 2 or 3 days. And so that day I talked to him, and it was just a connection like any of the other kids I worked with. But within like a couple of months, I mean, he made it to CSU. I would go pick kids up. As more kids started coming, though, I couldn't pick everyone up on my own. I had to set that boundary, and they had to get themselves there. And Liam, every week, would make sure he was there. We were Thursdays from 11 to 5, and he would come in the rain and in the snow and however else to get there. And then one day he told me, well, I used my SSI, and I got an apartment. And I was like, yes. And then a few months later, after I'd suspended services for a while, I'm always checking on the kids, they call me and everything, but I got a message on the CSU Youth website. I don't know where I am, but it's not good. And it was Liam, and he said he was out somewhere in Panhandle. He'd really messed up this time. And so I was preparing everything, putting in clothing back together and food back together and a sleeping bag, so I thought I was going to have to do some street outreach for him. And when he got back, I was so proud of him, because he came to the center, and I was giving all these things, and I said, so, you know, do we need to make some calls? And he said, no, the one thing I did before, big breakdown, the one thing I did was pay my rent before I took off, so I get to go home tonight. So everything in his apartment had been destroyed, stolen, rampaged, but he still had a place to sleep at night. So we're making an impact, even when these kids, you know, it's just that basic connection. And we just show them the opportunities that are out there. They might not take them for a while, but they know they have, there's some hope. So how it came to be that Liam walked in that day and all these kids have been helped through CSU was, I was one of those kids as a teen, poverty, a family with mental health issues. I'm bouncing around to different people's houses. There's, parents divorced young, and so I'm just kind of bouncing around. And my grandmother primarily took care of me, mother with epilepsy, bipolar disorder. And so I'd be out with her sometimes, and then some major traumas would happen, and we'd go back to grandma's. And, I'm 11 years old. My mom was having a seizure behind the wheel and pulled a car over for her and wouldn't give her keys back until she could tell me my name. And she finally did, so I said, let's go. So I'm pretty much taking care of my mom. But she ended up finding someone that she loved, and she got her own place. But then I started staying with my grandma, and as soon as I pretty much made D's and F's all through school, and so I didn't think there was any chance of college. So whenever I graduated, I decided, let's just roll with it. I had a trunk, packed it full of stuff, and I just stayed with friends all over the place, down Texas and California, and just went with it. I'm just going to be a hippie. I'm just going to see what happens. And I was actually living in Dallas and journaling a lot. And I would go down to Deep Ellum and hang out and get rides back to the apartment. We had like 8 roommates in this little really nasty 2-bedroom apartment. And I'd write in the journal, and there was one entry I made where I said, you know, I want to experience every ounce of life. I want to experience hitting absolute rock bottom and being able to come back from that and help people. And I wrote that when I was 20. And I still have that journal entry. But I'd forgotten about that. And actually someone called one day to make a donation. And she said, this is Russell's big sister. And Russell's a guy I used to sleep on his couch. And his big sister said, I remember you used to talk about this all the time. So I guess when I was a teenager, I was one to help people. I always had, like, my symbol was E and a Q for equality, because I just could not stand racism. And I couldn't stand homelessness. I just didn't understand how this was happening in our society. But so I did. I ended up hitting rock bottom. By the time I was 20, you know, you have roommates, they run off, the electric bill's in your name. After a while, you can't get an apartment, and, you know, you've already stayed with this person and that person. You just feel like nothing but a burden. After a while, you feel invisible. Socially, everyone, you know, in middle school and high school, I was the 50-cent kid. I was always asking for food money, and then after school, I was looking for a place to stay, and then it just, I had one aunt that could help me out, and I stayed there. My cousin, who is a biological father of my adopted children now, gangs and, you know, gunshots at the front of the house, and I'd be sleeping on his floor, and I had a backpack, and that's all I had, and he'd managed to get into that backpack and get my keys out or my paycheck, because I always worked, and steal my car or steal my money. And so I just started staying at Lake Thunderbird. They have those really great showers out there. So just going to go park and sleep in my pup tent and take a shower in the warm showers, and then go to work. And I know I only had 30 days of that. And you can't camp for a long time because they start catching on that you're homeless. But during that time, I met someone who really, really loved me. So we did the very stereotypical thing, and I moved in the next day with her. And we were together for 13 years. She loved me very much, and she made sure that I healed, and then we ended up separating, but we adopted our first boys together. The two of the five children that me and my current partner have. But during that time, getting the boys, so I experienced that DHS process and experienced bringing these boys home that Coda turned 3 the weekend I took them back to Arizona. I had healed, and I had this really great job with BNSF, a train conductor, running trains from Belen, New Mexico to Winslow, Arizona. It was really cool. But so we got the boys out to Arizona, but they told me that day that if you just love them hard enough, that they're going to be fine. You know, they've experienced severe trauma. They've been in foster care for 2 and 3 years before, you know, they were homeless themselves, living in a car, and saw all kinds of horrible things before they were age 3. But if you just love them for 6 months, everything will be fine. And the first night we just hit the road at 4 a.m. and stopped somewhere in New Mexico at a hotel, and the push-pull of these babies. Lation was 22 months old, and he was screaming, and then he would punch me in my face, and then he would collapse on me, and he'd scream and push me away, and then he'd collapse on me. And so the only thing that soothed him was walking. So I just walked around that hotel. I didn't know any nursery rhymes, so I sang 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 in a really melodic way for about 3 or 4 hours. And then took 4 or 5 hours, and then he finally passed out from exhaustion. And the other one, he had just turned 3 and just destroying everything in the room. And I called DHS the next day, and we're almost to Flagstaff. And I'm not equipped. I do not know how to, I'm a great aunt. I'm the cool aunt, but being a parent, I don't know what to do. And they said to me, well, if you can't handle it, we'll come get him and give him to somebody else. And I said, well, shit. I would never let that happen. And that call was desperation for help to understand how to navigate parenting with children that have experienced trauma. And so that was kind of the icing on the cake. my partner and I separated. I met Amber, her sister, lost custody of her four kids within the first year that Amber and I were together. And we all of a sudden had six. One of the kids had the brunt of the abuse, and we could not keep her in the home because of the trauma she experienced. She was extremely violent, could pick up huge objects and hurl them across the house at 4 years old, attack animals and brothers and sisters. So she is still in DHS custody. It's been 4 years. She's eight. Pauline Meyer shut down their state-run shelter, and now Chloe lives inpatient at 8 years old, and she's been there for over a year, and they can't place her. So all of these things are part of who I am. When we got those four kids, one of the things I had to do was we went from two kids every other week sharing custody to six kids. DHS was having a hard time paying kinship adopt foster family, so it took 6 months to get any funding. We were begging for dishes and soap and towels. And so being on the other side of that table, I mean, I'd been there before, but as a family, think about the families that have two, three, four, five kids. How do they get by ever? I don't understand. And then one of our oldest kids, she's now 18. She's just now coming out of her shell. She's a senior in high school, but she pretty much stayed in her bedroom, and she told us if she would have had a different option, she would have become independent. So that's part of CSU too. So how I modeled this was just trying to save myself as a teen, the children that I'm raising in my home, and offer options for all of us, for the kids who are suicidal because they're being rejected by their families for being LGBT or the extreme poverty or mental health in the home. They can't be there anymore. Kids struggling with generational addictions for a variety of reasons. I started digging in the metro area, Putnam City Schools, Middell Schools, and Oklahoma City Schools combined have about 10,000 students who qualify as homeless. That doesn't include the thousands who drop out. We don't know if they were McKinney-Vento qualified kids. That means qualify as homeless. So that 10,000 number could be a lot higher. We don't know. And that's just the students. Once the kids are turning 18, what's going on? We know up to 50% of youth who age out of foster care, 25 to 50%, people think it's more 50% experience homelessness. And when I started digging around too, it started off looking for LGBT-friendly services, but then I found there were no services for youth, period, that were experiencing homelessness. The only shelter now available for youth under the age of 18 is Family Junction, but you have to be in DHS custody to stay at that shelter. If you're over the age of 15, homelessness, by definition, according to DHS directors, does not constitute abuse or neglect. Therefore, you are not the responsibility of DHS if you are 15 or older and homeless. So, there's a catch-22. They can't get into the DHS shelters because you don't age in, you age out. And they can't get into the adult shelters or sign a lease because they're not 18. So they flip-flop from one horrible situation directly into another. A lot of other states have runaway homeless youth acts. You're runaway if you're homeless under the age of 18. You're homeless if you're over 18. We currently do not have one. We do not have we just don't have any legislation or DHS policy on youth homelessness. So at CSU Youth, we are writing the legislation, the DHS rules. We are navigating the way for homeless youth in Oklahoma from scratch. The shelter right now, we're experiencing a lot of pushback trying to house 16 to 20 year olds. Everyone is terrified of housing young people under the age of 18 that are homeless. But as I was driving down Western, I had a dorky smile on my face because I'm like, I'm going to be able to offer some help. But coming off I-40 up Western, you go between I-40 and 10th Street, and everybody is walking between City Rescue Mission and Jesus House, and so many young people in that crowd, and I'm smiling, waving at them because I'm like, I'm going to come back for you in my head. They're looking at me like I'm a weirdo, but soon we'll at least be able to stop in those crowds of kids and say, you know, you're under 24, I have a place for you to stay tonight. And we haven't been able to offer that. But whenever they're all in the same group, and half of that group is 16 and 17, the other half is 18 and 19 right now, I have to say, you guys can come, but you little kids, you got to go sleep with the adults tonight. So volunteerism would be advocacy. We plan on in January or February going to the Capitol and just bringing awareness to youth homelessness. The kids that we start working with at CSU, I want them to come with me. We have people that are working on legislation in the background, but we want to put a face to it in the foreground. So that's something we can do as volunteers. I'm probably not the only one who has experienced homelessness in this room or family rejection. It's a very personal issue to the LGBT community. 40% of homeless youth identify as LGBT. That statistic is hugely disproportionate. Also, up to 50% or maybe higher than that of the homeless youth population is African American. So this is almost the majority a black and LGBT youth issue. So volunteerism as well, we need to do outreach on the northeast side. When I go over there, the most talk I hear of God is when I walk on the streets around 23rd and MLK and just ask people if they're okay, do they need anything? And it's like I'm an alien that I would dare walk in onto MLK and 23rd and ask somebody if they needed help. It's in that area I get more just gratefulness that someone cares. So that is a very important area where we need to do some volunteering. There are just currently no social services over there. There's one food pantry. YWCU is over there. They're not over there anymore. It's just a desert of services. Not a lot of jobs either. I mean, you can go down after dark and drive through that area, and literally people are walking in the street, just nowhere to go. So, and then in the LGBT community, we need to start doing advocacy as well. We also need to do advocacy on the state level, and just be aware of, if you see someone walking down the street, we just take it for granted they're on their way to the friend's house, but if they're looking on the ground and they have a backpack, they probably don't have a place to go. So it's not that I want you to pull over your car and invite them in, because that could be quite, they get that a lot, I guess I would say. Most everybody wants something from these kids. Whenever I go out to talk to them, they're thinking I'm wanting to sell them drugs, them to sell drugs for me, or they want me to have sex, or, you know, there's always something. No one does anything for free. So these kids aren't used to that. So the awareness would just be contacting us, letting us know where you're seeing these kids. And then there are trainings, helping you train to know what to do in those instances. So we'll have volunteer trainings, not next weekend, but the weekend after, all day Saturday, and then Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday night. It's a pretty big training. We're discussing boundaries. De-escalation, what trauma looks like when it presents itself with these kids. Every one of these kids has experienced some sort of trauma just by being on the street. PTSD. So anyways, if you can sign up for the trainings, that would be wonderful, just to get more familiar with, you may be familiar with, but just to get some training on how to navigate your work with youths that have experienced trauma. But you can sign up for those trainings on the website. There's a volunteer button. Go down. It's real easy form. And then just show up on the day that we're having the training, and we'll get you more familiar, and then we can just really start helping these kids. So there's a lot of work to do, and I invite all of you to get involved, and we can absolutely make a difference. So thank you for listening to my big spiel. I told you I could go on for hours. CSU, I wanted a word that didn't give me props for the kids' work. I didn't want it to be something like, come here and we'll save you, because that's not what we're doing. I want it to be something, we open the doors of opportunity. We show you where the door of opportunity is, and we give you a little support while you do all the work. So Sisu means to see beyond present limitations, determination, strength, courage to succeed against extreme adversity and extreme odds. So it's just that desire to keep going when you don't think you can keep going anymore. So Sisu youth. So these kids, everyone who comes to us, that's what we are trying to instill in them, that we help them identify their strengths, their goals, their talents, and sometimes they've never even thought about it. They're so busy getting by day to day that they don't stop to think about themselves. We all know how that is. We just keep going, keeping our heads above water, and forget self-care and forget about ourselves. And this is a place where they can stop for a minute, breathe, and think, hey, I could do this. So that's what Sisu means. No, we let go of that one. We've been surviving on $10 to $100 donations for the last year and a half.
Are you going to move here and house kids downstairs?
We're not allowed to divulge that information. But it's a safe place for the kids, because the human trafficking and all of this, we have to protect the location of the facility, but we are working with Church of the Arm, Open Arms. So if you need any information, just talk to anyone, a member of the church, and they holler right at me. So any other questions? I was kind of all over the place there, so. All right.
Yes, it is a shelter.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I am very protective of these kids. I'm like a mother hen, but if I come off as too direct or something, it's just because I'm like mama hen, so.
I get it.
Sorry. Okay, any other questions? Yes. Yes, it hasn't been updated to our new information, but it has a lot of information about what we're doing. Yes, it'll have the website. And our website's real basic. It has 5 tabs at the top, and one of them is volunteer. And just push on that, and it's right there. I tried to make it as user-friendly as possible.
Other questions? Volunteer are like, we have clothing that needs to be organized. Maybe someone that can go home and wash clothing and bring it back to us. So we can, hang it up. And then different food items come in. I know the pantry here has been helping with that. But when the kids come in, stuff that we can put in backpacks. And before we ever had a shelter space, we would say, hey, if you're someone that can help us with hotel rooms and just help us have money that we can actually say, we have these children and we can put them in a hotel somewhere safe in the winter. We can put them here for so long. We've done some things like that. So there's monetary donations. There's clothing that needs to come in and be organized.
Our next big fundraising drive is going to be for $4,050 to get the plumbing for our washer, dryer, sink, and fridge into our shelter. We have to wash the bedding almost nightly, and the clothes that the kids come in with, and the towels and washcloths that they use in the shower. So we'll be doing laundry daily. It's really important to have that washer and dryer. But so our next fundraising drive will be that. But yes, we always collect hygiene products, for sure. We're always low on socks, and we're always low on deodorant, and gloves, hats. And then we're always going to have on hand sweatpants, sweatshirts, and just the plain white t-shirts. When they come in, they can go collect those things from the clothing closet, take their shower, get in some warm clothes. If you know some hairdressers, that makes a big difference too, getting the kids' haircuts. If they're willing to volunteer, I can make a list of hairdressers that'll give haircuts. When we did that at Sisu, it made all the difference. So, you know, the kids would be crying in the chair just getting a haircut because they appreciated it so much. So, hygiene products, blankets, sleeping bags. Because some of the kids, it's pretty strict policy. We'll be a 45-day program. If we can get the volunteers to sit at the overnight shelter, we'll be open every night. But fighting, we'll have to ask you to leave. Being disrespectful to anyone in the facility, you'll have to leave for the night. And that our big deal is going to be diversity. If you can't be with other, if you can't be with black youth or trans youth or gay youth, and you're disrespectful in any way, then you're the problem. They're not, and you're going to have to leave. But we don't want them to freeze. We will send them out with a backpack and or try to arrange a different shelter for them. So we're always going to need backpacks, warm clothing, hygiene products.
Thank you, Penny.
You're welcome.